dragged him into the lee of a big engine bulkhead, and forced him to talk properly. As he did so, hot sparks from the turning shafts spat and wriggled, cooling across the muddy deck. "Tell me your name," he said, summoning up as much of his old sense of command as he could.
"Captain Dantin," the man replied, looking terrified.
"No, that's my name. Just tell me your—"
"I am dead. I have no heart. I am a curse and a warning."
The man smiled, a sick grin that exposed gums as red as heart's blood and black holes where the teeth should have been.
"That was the last time." Now Dantin ignores the crowds that fill Solace's corridors. He bumps into them, and they say nothing. He shouts at them, and they do not hear him. Sometimes he just shouts anyway, hurling out his pain at the ship around him. The noise sinks into the dark metal, is gulped up by it, and is dissipated. He stops when he can no longer breathe, bent double, spitting up blood onto the spongy deck. Eventually, he finds his way to Philemon's sanctum. He has learned a little of the Talisman, overheard from the whispers of others. After Vorks, who is referred to like some distant kind of god, Philemon is the most well-known of the Unbroken to the Bilge-dwellers. They see him almost like a priest, a distant intercessor on their behalf, though Dantin himself thinks that this is confused, and that none of the monsters who run this ship really care anything much for the Unchanged, as they call them, the ones who never took the corrupted gene seed of the 14th Legion, and were thus morphed into diseased demigods. Dantin has passed the door to Philemon's realm on a number of occasions, each time when heading in a different direction. The place does not seem deeply rooted. One day, it will be found nestled below the main engine chambers. On another, it is located higher up, past the capillaries leading to the bridge. On this day, he stumbles across it after walking through the chambers of the rank and file Unbroken, the rooms like pig pens that house the many warriors of this vessel in their torpor. He pauses before the door. It is an archaic thing, a wooden planked panel bound by rusted iron in swirls that look wrong. It opens before he even pushes against it, and a blush of pale green mist hisses up from the deck across his bare feet. On the far side, the air is like rancid cream, thick and translucent. He sees things staring at him from high perches, the grotesque little lords gurning and burping. The smell is unbelievable, even for this ship. Locked inside some kind of glass chamber, a half-bald crow hops on its perch to fix a jeweled eye on him. There are lots more of these chambers, half-visible in the miasma, all different sizes and shapes.
"Abomination!"
the crow says. Dantin stares at it. The creature's beak curls like a long prehensile finger, and the effect is obscene. He should be revolted by the creature. He should try to kill it. Instead, though, he realizes that he finds himself merely curious. He repulses it more than it repulses him. He wonders why this is.
"You do not have a soul, mortal," comes a voice from the smoke and murk. "It cannot feed on you, and so it is disgusted by you."
The speaker emerges, limping out of the haze. He wears a long cowl that casts his face into shadow. His armor, for they all wear armor, these monsters, is as lumpen and misshaped as Vorks's, though free of the maddening numeric scrawl. Philemon's numerology is conducted on parchment, and reams of it tumble from every surface of this humid room, gently rotting and cracking and eroding.
"This is the currency of the universe," he says. "Not coin, not worlds. Souls. This is what we fight over. The strongest become stronger by them, the weaker are consumed. You, though, have been made irrelevant. You are a bystander in the game. You are despised by all sides. If we sent you back to your old masters now, they would burn you before you could tell them where you came from.
Better to burn than be damned, mutters Dantine wearily.
I wonder if anyone ever really believed that, says Philemon, placing a vial carefully on one of his many lopsided shelves. I suppose some must do, or you would not be able to staff your Inquisition.
Of all the many terrors and horrors on this ship, perhaps the worst had been the way these creatures talk. Their voices are achingly hard to listen to, bubbling with phlegm and grating across ancient withered vocal cords. But it is the mundanity of their discourse that chills him. They murder without a thought. They infect, they destroy, they mutilate themselves and their servants. They create this stinking, terrible realm in which to squat and vomit, and yet their words are so calm, so turgid, so consumed by the trivial. The Talleyman comes closer, and Dantine smells his rotten egg breath.
"You had it easy on Najan," Dantine says. "The consuls will fight you." "Yes, that is what we hope for."
"I hope they kill you all."
Philemon shoots him a dry smile, and it makes one of the boils on his upper lip burst.
"Let me tell you the strength of this vessel," he says. "It has weapons on it capable of rendering cities to dust. It has bombers, dreadclaws, heavy armor. There are things locked up in the dungeons here that you would not believe unless you saw them. Some of them frighten me."
Philemon chuckles, and the crow hops from one claw to the other.
"The Cardane are 7 strong, and there are 3 further squads of Terminators. 32 squads of unbroken fight under Vaux. Another 24 under the Gallowsmen. Some have given in to possession, and some have so many gifts they are like living diseases. There are thousands of unchanged who can fight harder and longer than any human. Some of them are almost impossible to stop once they get going, and we are so very good at getting them going. That is the strength, Captain. That is terrible strength. You have not seen it unleashed yet, so do not place so much faith in those who have already failed you once."
"They would have come in time,
if any still live."
The crow is looking at him all the time. Dantine half knows what it is. A ghost, a spirit, a ghoul. Many times while fighting on far-off worlds, the mud of trenches thick on his boots, he had heard stories of such things. It was never easy to disbelieve them, and now it is impossible. He is inside a dream now. A dream where all his darkest imaginings are made into hard-edged reality, and insanity has solidified into what counts for sanity. Dantine glances about him. He sees complex calculations traced in brown ink on thick parchment. He sees rusty devices, armillary spheres, sextants, chronometers, half covered in mildew-spotted cloth.
"You call us ignorant," he says, trying to sound defiant. "And yet, look at you. Look at the conditions you live in. Do you not disgust yourself when you pass a mirror? Do you not see what you could have been?"
The crow laughs. Dantine tenses, ready for a blow from the armored monster. But it never comes. Philemon looks thoughtful.
"But I was in the warp," he says, "when we were becalmed. I still remember. I scratched the days on my armor, one after the other."
Dantine listens. He doesn't know what the monster is talking about, but says nothing. The crow listens. The little lords still their quarrelling, and they listen too.
"When the destroyer came, I resisted it. We all did. We had been trained for it, and we had resisted everything up until then. Defiance or else death. Every legion taught that to some degree, and we taught it more than most. I thought there was nothing I could not endure that did not kill me.
The Taliman is not focusing now. He is witnessing events far away.
But we were out of time in the end. There were no days to mark any more. The pain was eternal. No beginning to it, no end. We were just part of it. Forever. And I still ask myself now, what really happened? Did we give in? I don't know. Typhus tells us we overcame it, and in taking it within ourselves, we transformed it. We no longer feel it. We bring the lesson of that to the universe. Accept corruption. Let it pass within you. Move beyond it. We have been doing it for a very long time. You forget after a while that there was another life you had. That is less than a memory now, less than a shadow, but not quite dead yet. Every time I see one of you, a part of it comes back.
You were made to protect us, Dantine says.
They were never made for that,
the crow blurts.
They were made to end the galaxy.
So what do I see when I look in the mirror?
Philemon asks, ignoring the demon.
I do not look, so I do not know. Perhaps the sight would pain me. I suspect it would not. You don't look so good yourself. I suggest you stay away from them too.
Don't you want the... Dantine ventures, trying one last time, probing at anything that might be a weak point. A part of him just wants to know. A way back. Philemon smiles, a gesture that exposes dark purple gums.
There are no ways back, he says. That is the only unchangeable fact of the universe. Even the gods do not break that law. Tread the path to its end, or tread no path at all. There are no resting places. There are no ways back.
Dantine stares at him, shivering a little. The tone of finality chills him. He would like to imagine that the monster expresses something like remorse in those words, but he cannot detect any. He thinks then that they have indeed been driven mad, and that they now no longer see the world as it is, but as some kind of impenetrable mental prison. They imagine themselves masters of their fate, but are instead puppets of a greater power, mouthing religious words that mean nothing, and worshipping a deity that, if it even exists at all, can care nothing for them, or any sentient thing, for it is just a consumer of these souls, an engine for which the living are merely fuel. But then there are many in the universe of whom such things could be said. Perhaps the souls they toy with are indeed the only currency there is, and all players, whatever allegiance they claim, accept the same stakes at the same table. So does the heretical thought slip in for the first time, like a sigh of hearth-warm air, over an open threshold. He looks up at the Taliman's ruined face.
They'll kill you, he says. The Emperor's angels. They'll kill you all.
They might, says Philemon. But then, as you're discovering yourself, there are worse things than an honest death. So, we'll see. We'll see it all in the end.
It's 2 days standard before the comm signal comes in from the Iamandar. This is a long time to contemplate a course of action, even for a legion so bound up in ritual and portent. Perhaps they have consulted with some other entity at distance, but it would take longer than that to send and receive anything using the astropathic choirs, so it remains likeliest that they were just thinking things through. Vaux spends most of that time on the bridge, motionless, watching the opposing ship as it circles around them slowly. He is undisturbed by the bridge crew, who are used to his obsessions, and limp and scuttle around him as if he were just another part of the ship's structure. Only the little lords dare to impose themselves, breaking his concentration. On each occasion, he stoops to pick them up, and they coo and snicker at the attention. They extend long black tongues to lick at the old wounds on his armor, and they spend hours clumsily attempting to fix the long rents in his decaying ceramite. Eventually, something lights up on a panel, and an unchanged attendant with red rings under empty eye sockets scrabbles around for a decoding filter. Long before he has done so, Vaux has interpreted the runes piped to his internal system. He gives some thought to subtext, for the senders are particular about inserting multiple layers of meaning to even the basest missives, and he extrapolates what he can. The results are pleasing enough. No overt insults, no overt threats. It is refreshingly pragmatic. Perhaps he thinks that this is the way things will be from now on. He stirs himself. A little lord is dislodged from his shoulder and slithers down the ridged edges of his plate. Hovik is already hauling herself up from the sensor pits in order to be in place for the coming order burst.
"Summon the gallowsmen! Summon the Cardane, master," Vaux says, lumbering back to his throne. "Open a channel to Ro Tway."
The bridge of a Death Guard warship is a sluggish place. Orders are followed, but the movements are languid, hampered by the withering of muscle and the slow softening of minds. For all that, commands find their homes in the end, and solace judders and booms into something a little more lively. Lumens flicker up to operational intensity, and cracked picture lenses flicker back into life. Out in the void, the Iamandar is lighting up, too. Tiny tongues of flame blurt and throttle in braziers, and its flanks glow with rekindled searchlights. The huge empty caverns of its main thrusters shimmer with the first rush of ignited fuel, then burst out into thunderous activation.
"Standing ready, Lord,"
comes Ro Tway's voice over the comm.
"Kindling in process. The furnaces will take a while to..."
"Expedite, if you please, Cultivator," Vaux says. "They are expecting us to lead them."
The bridge deck flexes a little then, as Garstag clomps his way out from the access doors. Dragon is not far behind, swinging his naked bladed hand, which seems to have grown a little since the slaughter on Najan.
"We have an answer,"
asks the Cardane master, as wary as the others at the prospect of an alliance with heretics.
"They accept our terms," Vaux says. "The world is to be taken, its spoils divided in equal shares."
Garstag laughs.
"They will have their knives out long before that." "So everyone keeps telling me."
Vaux sounds a little weary of this, and Garstag has the sense to let it drop.
"Bring Drez-Uil to me," Vaux says to Hovik. "And Captain Dantine. The last stage will be the hardest, and I wish to demonstrate that we mean what we say and can do what we claim."
Solace's engines are running now, its arteries unclogging with thick shots of tainted promethium. The bellows are cranking up, the pilot lights are flaring into rolling balls of dirty flame. As ever, the old structure creaks and bangs. The little lords scowl and put their claws over their ears. They do not like this level of disturbance, and one of them burrows under the feet of the command throne, its claws scraping rapidly on the deck.
"So, what did he say?"
asks Dragon, curious despite himself.
"The Apostle... that he accepted the tactical situation. For a moment I almost believed him. Where is Naum?" proving hard to track down. There are rumors that he's under the main prow, and I've sent 20 of my blades to find him. Go yourself. I want him in the first wave.
Dragan nods cautiously.
Then it will not be long, he says. Not long at all.
Vorx takes the heart out of the pouch at his belt. It is still wet with blood, still beating. As he handles it, it trembles, and the pace of beats picks up.
It knows. Somehow, it knows.
He looks at Dragan, and there is something there now. A stirring of spirits rising up from sluggish depths.
Fury is coming, Gallowsman, he says. Fury is coming to another world.
Six. The Gate Breaks. Chapter 13. The fleet breaks up, spirals away from the core, splinters like gravel dashed against stone. The greater number bear down on distant Cadia, carrying desolation to that hated world under the vengeful spirit's shadow. But there are other targets in the grand scheme. Other worlds in the gate sector are walled and guarded, and other worlds offer threats to the flanks of Abaddon's advance. Despite its proximity to the eye, humanity's borders here teem with life, every half-habitable asteroid carved out and built up into hypercities and mega-fortresses, and the High Lords have crammed every single gun tower with precious souls. The Despoilers' captains know their assigned roles. Their warp drives reignite, the still-hot Enginariums drumming up again to full potential. Destroyers streak off into the Empyrean, followed by the wallowing hulls of the major killers. Demons shriek and gamble in their wakes, sensing the chasm of reality flexing around them. The names of their targets are ancient, known to every slave child of the Eye, and murmured by every cult priest over every altar. Cadia, Nemesis Tessera, Belis Corona, Skellus. The rote is a litany of hatred hissed from chapped and bleeding lips for 10,000 years. Curses are laid on those worlds within the bronze cathedrals of Sicarus, ramping up the hostility of the slumbering warp and rousing its denizens from torpor. They are close together, by galactic standards, huddled within the sclerotic clutch of major warp conduits, each one a citadel and an armory of the most resilient kind. Orbital stations bristle with long-range gunnery, and permanent fleets stalk the space lanes above them. Entire armies drill endlessly within mighty barracks, and fresh tanks trundle off never-ending production lines. Outside the Sol system itself, there is no greater concentration of defenses in the entire galaxy, and all of them need constant resupply and refueling. Their machines are never allowed to degrade, and their weapons are never allowed to rot. They must be fed with the metal marvels of old Mars. They must be given teeth. Thus it is that Agrippina assumes prominence. Agrippina, the closest great forge world to Cadia. Agrippina, the source of its finest armaments, its Titan legions, its heavy armor, and its ranged artillery. Agrippina is an iron world, never at rest, studded with foundries and seas of liquid metal. Its skies are lead gray, its surface clad in unbroken construction. No hives or habs pucker its ancient surface, only manufactoria, kilometer after kilometer of them, dazzling the mortal mind. Fires vent like daggers of blood, and the dark iron glints hot under the running clouds. Red lightning snaps over the cowled heads of the priesthood's minions, skittering from one control tower to another in a never-ending, semi-ritual procession. Skitari maniples travel in machine lockstep across the high causeways, while below, in the pits and the shafts and the wells, the hammers rock, the pistons slide, the wheels turn. Agrippina has done this for longer than the Imperium itself has endured. The ziggurats were raised in the forgotten age of strife, long before the traitors made their pacts, long before there were traitors, long before the first foundations of that secret throne room were delved under the warring crusts of terror. On Agrippina, There are secure vaults, lost under rad-stained sands, containing flaking paper blueprints from the dawn of the human age. Some of these vaults are lost even to those who still inhabit the world, for the accretions of the long, long years have buried so much in forgetfulness. There are whole cities lost on Agrippina, smothered by later frenzied constructions, plundered for their resources before being allowed to steadily erode into the substrates of the old continents as the endless metronomic activity continues far above them. It would take a baseline human a week to travel from the highest exhaust vent down to the lowest coolant sink, clambering down the soul-crushing press of girders and pylons and into the gaseous depths. Not that an unaugmented human would survive the journey. Agrippina was long ago made extravagantly toxic, its atmosphere turned to poison gas, and its aquifers acidified. On Agrippina, the augmetics start from the birth pods, infants yanked from gurgling metal wombs, their heads branded and their blood drawn. Every scrap of flesh is shaped, stamped, wired up and clamped down. Their lungs are made able to process the atmospheric poisons, their eyes made capable of withstanding the flares from the forges, their fear centers tugged out, their endocrine systems tailored for whatever drone function Agrippina demands of them. Obedience, aggression, endurance. Agrippina has weathered storms before. The sector was ravaged in past centuries, the so-called 12 Black Crusades of the Imperial Lawmasters, each time more severe than the last, each time requiring more strenuous efforts to rebuild, to bear down on non-conforming elements, to purge datasets and binary sinks. It has always recovered. It has always covered over the wounds with freshly poured rockcrete. It has always built greater manufactoria where the old ones were annihilated. This was necessary. Without Agrippina, Cadia would be starved of its machines. Without Agrippina, the other worlds would be naked and defenseless. This is the place that gives them teeth. Thus, by necessity, it has been marked for destruction. Agrippina has been under attack for a long time already. Plagues have been thrown at it, carried on hulks, vomited up from the eye's turbulent borders. Hordes of shambling dead have clogged its vents and its cog clusters. Rogue tech priests have damned what remained of their souls by destroying critical systems and jamming integral works. One third of the Great Command ziggurats have gone dark, their innards seething with civil conflict. Agrippina's daughter worlds, its supply depots and its naval dockyards, are all aflame now, grappling with a sudden emergence of suicide squads and activated sleeper units. That was just the start. The softening, the tenderizing. It was all that could be done from afar, all that could be accomplished without breaking the gate's wards and sending physical warfleets to truly summon the apocalypse. Now the fleets are here. This is Agrippina's reality. The first alerts sound on System Edge, prompting an immediate response from stationed void assets. Imperial Navy attack groups race to intercept, bolstered by colossal shadows of the Basilicon Astra's heavy maulers. Space Marine strike cruisers dart from under those lumbering giants, their flanks colored in the livery of a dozen chapters. Defense plates activate, their concave summits sliding back to reveal Nova cannons and system-class disintegrators. Whole maniples of Skitari mobilize, their spine clusters spiked into activation, their viewfinders whirring up to bottle-green luminosity. From deep within Agrippina's iron guts, shutters grind back from the moors of silo temples, and the god-machines of the Legio Presidium Vortex emerge from their deep tombs, warhorns echoing across the burning metal plains. And yet they can have no idea. Somewhere, deep within all those ruthless logic minds, bled of emotion and dread, they must still see what comes from them out of the eye's lightning-raked skirts, and be daunted. Their oculi whining to gain focus, they must look up at the skies and struggle to comprehend what has taken place, and feel the coldest flicker of doubt. What they see has no precedent. What they see has no explanation. What they see has no rational basis, for hell's borders have been shattered, its fetters thrown off, and the vengeance of the damned now spills across real space. The moment can only be fleeting.
It all happens so fast. The flames are like a breaking wave. The demon screams like shattering crystal. The mast thrusters like the ignition of new stars. There are so many. So many. Thus it begins. Solus thunders into range, flanked on either side by fast attack craft of the World Eaters and Night Lord's legions. The orbital zone around it is half void, half flying debris, clotted with shrapnel since the destruction of the outer orbital defense stations. Molten pieces clang and bounce from the ship's outer shielding, spinning madly before being engulfed in fresh walls of plasma and thruster burn. Everything is in perpetual motion, a whirl of confined cause and effect. Giant warships sweep across the reeling visual plane, each one sucking in clouds of smaller craft. Wings of gunships and void fighters streak and duck through flashes of lasfire. The burning planet's surface rolls below them, swinging lazily, as if stuck on a pendulum, its torment caught in glimpses within the tumble and plummet. Vorx is standing on the command bridge, calculating, assessing, issuing an order every so often, and watching the grand display unfold across his many picta lenses. Explosions pepper the forward augers, rolling silent flowers that bloom and fade, and are then dragged out into dying slivers. The deck shakes as the big guns fire, belching acid bombs into the oncoming prows of Imperial war vessels. Solus's weapons are old. Some were forbidden even in the earliest days of the Crusade, while others have been slowly made blasphemous by the corruption of the Neverborn. Some fire solid rounds, others ghost-green lasblasts, but most are more imaginative. Phosphex and corrosives, metal gnaw and bone rot, core decay and fuel spoil. The ship tilts leeward, hit by a brace of burrowing torpedoes, its hide ripped and venting. Vorx directs return fire, gently nudging Solus's own inclinations, and a withering slam line of adamantium-eating canisters spins out into the void. The impacts are void silent, clouts of lime-yellow puffs strung along the flank of a Cobra-class destroyer. Only moments later the destructive agents do their work, chewing through armor layers and rupturing a generator feed line. Vorx has already ordered Solus on to new targets by the time the Cobra's outer skin is blown and its atmospheric controls are smacked out of tolerance. It falls away, easy prey now for the swarms of mid-range killers sweeping up in Solus's wake. Vorx has his mind on greater things. Amid the crash and the shatter, there are true monsters in the herds, sentinels that must be eliminated if the landings are to be effected. He sees the Slaverer, a World-Eater's battleship, smash its way into close contact with the throne's divine demands. A Retribution-class ship of the line, and that titanic clash is beyond him. He sees a squadron of Navy cruisers in close formation batter an incoming wedge of Murder-class skirmishers, and that entire sector of the battlesphere erupts into dazzling pyrotechnics. There are 1,000 individual struggles here, all combining to form the immense conflagration that stretches far across Agrippina's tortured horizon, reaching out like some giant, single, flickering claw to clutch the Forge World and tear it from existence.
"That one," he whispers, picking out a blip on the overloaded sensor wheels, a dab of phosphor amid a speckle of 100 other targets.
Hovik is already working to bring them in close. Rotway drags up a little more power from straining plasma coils. Drez-Ul, shackled now to his greasy panopticon throne, shouts out vectors that the servitors mumble and transmit down to implementation decks. Vorx is alone on the high bridge. The rest of the Unbroken are preparing for their own battles, the tight locked thrust of boarding actions or the hurtle down into planetfall. He knows Dragon will be goading the gunnery teams before making for the torpedo bays, grinding a little more from them. He thinks that Garstag is making ready for teleportation, but has not yet detected his locus, which is strange, but there is so much going on that he cannot attend to it.
"That one,"
he says again, reaffirming it, marking it, making it his own. It is a mass conveyor, a huge carrier, lightly armed but with steep-sided armor plates and a heavy profile. It is bigger than Solus, approaching battleship size, but clumsy and slow, and lacking major armament. Squadrons of frigates, all in Mechanicus Red, shoot alongside it as it powers up from Agrippina's orbital dock layer, building up to escape speed through the burning wreckage. Such a thing is not a major target for the assault commanders. It is clearly running from combat, shepherded out by its escorts, seeking refuge from the Maelstrom's heart before the orbital zone is overrun. Thus it is being ignored, for there are 1,000 true attackers driving straight at the invaders, their lances spitting and their broadsides roaring. As the battle thunders over the Forge World's glowing edge, the surviving orbital stations open up in a combined salvo, sending waves of armor-battering ordnance screaming out of recoiling macro-barrels. It is overwhelming, computationally complex, unfolding across the full gamut of all three dimensions. There are thousands of things to be concerned about, thousands of more lethal things. This one ship, though, intrigues Vaux. He has fought the soulless disciples of the Machine God many times and has learned their ways. They do not retreat from Forge Worlds. They do not send their assets out into the void for another, better day. In combat such as this, where their pride and industry are threatened with annihilation, they use every last one of their ships, all their guns, all their dreary, flesh-stripped troops. Even if that mass conveyor only carried a scattering of las cannons and was chock-full of inert cargo, it would still be sent howling into the heart of combat and used, if for nothing else, to soak up incoming fire, while the greater Arc Mechanicus battleships dealt out the true pain. So something does not ring true. Perhaps the world-eaters are too distracted by their blood frenzy to notice it, and maybe the warp-smiths of the Black Legion are so intent on getting down to the surface that they are overcommitting. This is not a tactical weakness Vaux possesses. He does not really hate this enemy. It is rare for him to hate, and he has never hurried an advance in his life. So he has the luxury of study, of reflection, and sees that a mass conveyor of the Basilican Astra has no place being there at all.
"All fire concentrated on the prow," he orders, noting with satisfaction how smoothly Solus turns into the attack trajectory and how solidly it is absorbing the constant barrage of incoming lasfire from many fronts. The armor on the ship is like a layer of rotting fat, sucking and dissolving the hits that come in, making the ship absurdly but agreeably resilient. Solus picks up a little more speed, now powering close to its optimal velocity, booming through the crowded battlesphere and crunching through the thickets of lesser craft. Its sides flash and flicker with a constant hammer of close-range fire, picking off the gunships and boarding torpedoes sent to intercept it. Kodad is doing well, surrounding Solus with an aura of well-aimed destructiveness. A naval battleship in the middle distance briefly locks onto them, causing warning rooms to scroll across the pictures, but it is almost immediately engaged by a world-eater's strike cruiser hurtling along at ramming velocity, and the two of them fall into bloody close-contact mauling. The mass conveyor powers on. Its escorts recognize the danger and swing in closer. Solus takes hits, serious ones, ones that might drive deep under all that fat and damage something critical.
"Ignore it," Vaux says. "Concentrated fire. Main power to the lances."
It is getting rough. They are getting knocked hard, and the void shields crackle and buckle. The frigates spar like enraged insects, cutting down further, but Solus just barrels closer, drinking the hatred up, dulling it, blunting it, slowing it all down. The ship's structure flexes, indicating that core power has been shunted aforeships, burning down the conduits to the lance generators. The mass conveyor is still running on its old course, a huge hunk of red-flaked metal carrying the eroded sign of the Mechanicus on its facing armor. Vaux studies it. Immense side plates, tall as hive spires, big aft-slung burners sending crimson plasma coruscating out into the shrapnel-flecked vacuum, tiny viewport lights at the very summit of a rear-mounted command bridge. It is a brute, a grim pile of undistinguished slabs designed with no sense of the organic or the mortal. It is the work of those who have let their spirits go cold
and such construction does not deserve to endure in this galaxy of wonder. Kodad lets loose, and the first lance beam arcs out from Solus's prow array, wreathed in spitting fronds of pale green plasma. The beam strikes true, smacking into the conveyor's snub nose and splashing messily over the void coverage.
"Again!"
says Vaux, bracing himself as more hits come in. Other ships are responding now. Imperial vessels, Mechanicus vessels, Legion vessels. It is still a whirling madness out there. Ships sliding across other ships, fire barrages searing across the void and blowing auger nodes, fighter wings burrowing into every cranny between the rolling behemoths. But through it all, the conveyor drives its straight path, edging closer to wherever it was ordered to be. Its bow plates begin to crack open, just a trace at first, a line of fire down the long snub nose, then a vent of gases and a hall of metal. Vaux allows himself a half-smile. Something has been hidden in that ship, warded by nondescript armor designed to protect Titans during transit. Now it is being revealed, forced into the open, a hand exposed before its time. Solus fires again, scores another hit, this time striking at the join between moving panels. The liquid energies cascade through the opening gaps and corrode through to softer materials beyond. The conveyor barely flinches, but damage has been done. Vaux detects void-shielding harmonics ramping up, and his augers isolate violent power shifts across the giant's energy lattice. The conveyor's escorts are diving in hard now, slamming everything they have at Solus, trying to rip off its heavy shields and get a clean shot down into its rotten insides. A vicious rake of torpedoes finds its mark, strafing the starboard underhull and making the lumens plunge out for a few seconds. Damage reports flash up on grimy lenses, half hidden behind ingrained detritus. A little lord cries out in terror, clambering up a pillar, hand over hand, and wedging itself in the angle of the roof braces.
"Hold course," says Vaux, softly, watching, watching.
The target races into true visual, gobbling the space on the forward viewers and turning the void a dull red.
"All we have now! Fire at will!"
The command filters down the long chains, the vox circuits and the muttering servitor relays, and everything explodes. Lancers unleash, macro cannons splurt, phosphex launchers belch. Solus briefly disappears behind clouds of its own discharge, a billowing wave of corrosive horror that streaks out across the gap and crashes hard into the flickering shell of the conveyor beyond. The detonation is blinding, a nova of void energy that flares and burns and then blasts itself out. The shockwave sends the hurtling frigates toppling prow first over their gravity centers. The conveyor's opening doors are hurled apart, ripped from their hinges, and sent teetering for a frozen moment amid a seething roil of wild energies. The entire structure staggers, barged off its steady course, its blood-red burners thundering hard to compensate. And then, for the first time, all can see what has been hidden on that ship. Its bow plates are stripped clean, revealing a cavernous interior, ribbed and barred, and braced for strength. Jutting out of all that cross-fixed metal is a single barrel, an obscene length of rust-red iron studded with effigies and skulls and all the tedious ephemera of the machine god's acolytes. The interior of the conveyor is a vivid red, as bloody as the rest of it, but glowing now like the heart of a blacksmith's furnace. Vaux immediately recognizes what has been hidden there, and for a moment feels a tremor of excitement in his cynical old bowels. This is a rarity, something precious to the enemy, something to be concealed during the ascent to the battlesphere and used to cause a single instant of outrageous destruction. Perhaps it was intended for Kosalax himself, the nominal commander of this stitched-together armada, who presides over the hellship Conqueror at the very center of the fiercest fighting. It is preparing to fire, caught off guard and now rushing to deploy the payload festering within its bowels. Curls and slivers of lightning scamper across those great apertures, snaking down the length of the gun itself. The void, already tortured by a million pulses of Laz energy, begins to boil,
and visual distortion ripples across the barrel's gaping maw.
"Place us in front of it," Vork says.
Vork has been commander of this ship for a long time, and his authority on the bridge is absolute. Even so, Hovik looks up at him just for a second. She is so hunched now, bent double, the end cannot be far for her, or perhaps the transformation into something better. Who can tell? In any case, she is perturbed, and for good reason.
"The gun, Lord?"
she asks. Vork gazes down at her fondly.
"Close as you dare," he says. "Scrape the paint off it, if we can."
They do not comply at once. They can see the danger, the ludicrous danger, and they are not quite inured to it, despite all they have been shown of the god's benison and their commander's tactical experience. But it is only a hesitation, a momentary failure, for they are a good crew, one into which Vork has poured all his long benevolence and careful acumen.
"By your will, Lord,"
says Hovik. She turns solace to intercept, her grey eyes dull to fear. Chapter 14 Row-Tway is stumbling, for the deck is lurching around heavily, and her legs are buckled and lesioned. Death has been pawing at her shoulder for a long time. She is not overly concerned about her increasingly difficult life ending, but there is always duty enough to keep her on her feet, and she does care about that. She was born on this ship. She knows no other existence but that of its clammy corridors and its slopping decks. Her eyes are milky white, her skin like translucent parchment. She is perfectly adapted to the dark, to the slightly higher-than-standard gravity, to the heat and the moisture. She reaches out to grab onto pipework, steadying herself. She knows where every rivet and piston head is, and treads around the obstacles surely. This is mostly instinct now. You can't learn Solace's layout in the normal way, for it changes all the time. Bulkheads shift, engineering components move. Some sections are becoming heavily organic, pulsing and perspiring in the dark, whereas others clang with unusual internal noises. Every time Rotwe removes a casing, she does not know what she will see. A nest of bloatworms writhing amid the valves, a pair of proto-lungs shivering as they suck up engine oil, or perhaps just bare metal, clicking over as it should. That is why she is the cultivator, as much a custodian of living things as inert materials. One day, far into the future, the entire ship will be a single amorphous organism. She is helping to make this a reality, to coax and to nurture. It is hard work, back-breaking and relentless, but it gives her a certain measure of pride. She has sons and daughters growing up in the lower decks, already learning to grasp a ratchet and siphon a fuel sump. If they survive the mutations and the plagues, one of them might one day become a cultivator. And if they are blessed with fertility, in centuries to come, one of their progeny might be there on that mystical and long-awaited day when Solace speaks for the first time, not in hisses of steam or scrapes of iron, but in a real voice, with real words. Rotwe moves off again, a welder gun in one hand, the other pushing against the grease-slick walls. A brace of lifter servitors chunters along behind her, their bulky frames grating up against the mesh roof of the narrow ways. Weak lights glow and flare in the heavy dark, exposing caked-on grime and curdled runoff. Vork is asking a lot of her, but then he always does. The plasma drives are dangerously hot, their enormous chambers shaking with a haze of racing pre-burners. She has seen conduits give out, filling entire sublevels with poison gas. Now it is the main isolator unit, the gangle of valves and pressure pumps that switches motive power from the warp drives to the plasma drives. Something has collapsed within the main tower, and so she hurries to clamp it down. This takes her a long way from the engineering control, down under a row of big plasma conduits, tubes the diameter of a hab unit that shoot under reinforced deck plates for 500 meters. She can hear the contents swill and boom within the pocked enclosure, yearning to burst out and drench them all in a tide of flesh-melting corrosiveness.
"What will be,"
she muses, humming a merry prayer to the god while fighting her way down the narrowing capillary route. It is then that she sees the shape, a long way down, half hidden behind a screen of pressed metal gantries and criss-crossed struts. The air is thicker down there, made into a backlit swamp of sick green, so that the colossal engine components around them are black silhouettes over a churning chasm. It is a walkway, slung perilously between the convex outlines of big support piles. Something moves across it, half visible in the drifting smog. An unbroken, surely, too huge to be anything else. Maybe huger than that, even. A Cardane, bulked up by all that overlapping plate. Rotway crouches for a moment, unsure what to do. The servitors behind her clatter to a halt. Surely the unbroken will detect her, but perhaps the din from the drives is too much. Or perhaps he is off on his own mission, displaying all that single-minded resolve that they do so well, oblivious to anything around him that poses no threat. The mists clear for a moment, blown into tatters by the belch from a brass valve head, and she sees things a little more clearly. Yes. It is the Lord Garstag heading down to where the warp-drive foundations are turbo-bolted into the underpinnings of the Engineering Zone. What can he be doing there, she wonders. What could bring him down to this place while there is fighting to be done? But then the miasma closes again, wafted by powerful currents from below. Up ahead, she hears the first harsh rattle from the innards of the isolator tower. It sounds like a major component has come loose, rattling around its housing and threatening to break out. She glances down again and sees nothing. He is gone. Perhaps he was never there at all. Solas does send phantasms from time to time, especially when the mind is oppressed or preoccupied. So she presses on, panting and sweating, her servitors in tow. She must remember to inform the Lord Vaux about this, when time allows. But there are things to do while the ship is fighting. So many things to do. Hovik does as she is asked. That is impressive, for this maneuver must look to her like suicide. Solas is lumbering now, struggling to maintain speed. One of the many dozen frigates has scored a palpable wound, and it sears the plasma drives and bleeds out momentum. Another enemy has managed to get a cluster of torpedoes hitting just the foreships of the bridge, knocking out a major sensor cluster. The effect on the bridge is strange, like putting on blurred Oculus filters. But the enemy cannot stop this now. Solas is too close to its target, too massive, and with too much of that all-important momentum. The crippled conveyor is trying to nudge out of range, but its engines are not designed for battlefield response. Somewhere on that ship, Vaux thinks, they are beginning to panic. Solas's bows slip across the churning well of the gun's maw. Its shadow slides across still crackling iron plates, darkening an already dark red hull. The gap between edges is now perilous, just a few hundred meters, in void terms, almost nothing. Scraps of plasma lightning jump across the emptiness, briefly linking the two behemoths together before sparking into nothing. Vaux feels another faint thrill, another faint stir. He has placed his ship between the cannon and its target. It is a sacrificial move, one destined to provoke the tech priests to fire now and unleash whatever they have wrapped up inside those layers of ugliness. Now Solas is fully across the kill zone, interposed between the gun's muzzle and the rest of the battle. Vaux can feel the tenseness on the bridge, the tightness of the jaws, the darting looks up at him from the pits. Any moment they expect to hear the explosions, the race of fire from the lower decks, the cold gasp of the void as it comes to grip them. He lets himself imagine the same thing, just for a second. He visualizes the eruption from below, and the howl of flame and racing atmospheres, and enjoys it. To linger any longer, however, would be indulgent. The priests on that conveyor do not want to fire. Vaux is old enough and learned enough to recognize the pattern of their precious weapon. It is Nova cannon class, though larger than all but the very most ruinous battleship-slung varieties. Such guns are designed for extreme-ranged fire, and its gunners would not detonate at this proximity, given the choice. That basic situation, though, on its own, would not normally be enough to keep them alive. A daring Mechanicus captain would take the risk to clear their sights, even if Solus's destruction did some collateral damage of its own. But Vorks knows all the species of Imperial System-class weapons. He has spent centuries cataloguing them and cross-referencing them. He knows the difference between a shell created on Lucius and one created on Mars. Indeed, he knows the difference between a shell created in the Northern Hemisphere macro-factories of Lucius and a shell created in the same world's slightly less capable Southern Hemisphere standard production forges. He has often found such knowledge useful, for all that younger minds scoff at it, and this situation is no different. That cannon, he sees by its marks and dimensions, fires rift shells. On impact, rift shells open a short-lived tear into the warp, sending everything within their blast sphere ripping into immaterialism. It is a horrifying weapon, capable of eating clean through the armored hide of the greatest of warships, and requires enormous resources to deploy and engage. But it has its drawbacks. The destruction sphere is massive. Solus is now so close that if the cannon fired, both ships would be sucked into the resultant vortex and caught up in a mutual embrace of destruction. The conveyor's true target would thus never be hit, and whatever plan it was intended to achieve would go unexecuted. The Mechanicus would hate that. Right now, Vorks knows they are running every algorithm ever burned onto their systems to extract the weapon from this situation without its loss. They will not do so for long. Very soon, perhaps even this very second, they will realize that there is no escape from this tangle, and that they really need to fire. The order will burn across the command synapses in the conveyor's heart, damning both ships to oblivion. So Vorks acts. This momentary hesitation, generated by the tech priest's greatest and most excusable failing, pride in their creations, was all he required to get into position.
"Tox dump! All vents! Full capacity!" he orders, sending the comburst simultaneously to all command nodes with highest priority attached, knowing that the more acute of his section commanders will already have guessed what he has in mind and set things in train. And they have. Hatches slam back, pipes stiffen into full capacity, blast doors grind open. A thousand orifices across Solus's underside gape, and the greenish flicker of void shield snatches out. The ship's bowels open. The effluent is thick, black, stiff, and frothing, a concentrated slurry of everything foul and curdled from the very depths of the warship's chem-drenched intestines. It is the liquefied bones of strangled Neverborn, the excreta of the apothecarians, the refuse of the bioweapons labs, the runoff from Slurt's crowded experiment tables. For decades, it has all stewed in the Geller-shrouded containment tanks, fermenting and coagulating and spawning under heat lamps. New things have emerged in that soup of horror, chains of metal-gnawing molecules that copulate madly with strings of flesh-dissolving bacteria. The whole morass is shot through with the demonic, bound by the warp and coalesced into void-defying globules. When it shoots out like projectile vomit into open space, it does not freeze dry and explode. It only gushes more strongly, streaming in incontinent torrents in search of firm matter to latch onto. The impact is horrific. Tons and tons of it in a roaring, bubbling cascade, crashing lumpily into the crackling cannon jaws and flooding down into the chasm beyond, overwhelming and choking, foaming like an incoming riptide. The conveyor's weakened void shields are smashed aside. The cataracts seethe across every exposed plate. The lightning is drowned. The fires are drowned. All is drowned under that magnificent, stomach-turning payload of ruin. A purge Solus proceeds on course, stately and unhurried, while the conveyor crumples in on itself, its structure now being eaten alive. There are explosions from deep within, as power cables are burned through. It loses trajectory, its acid-pocked prow dipping back towards Agrippina's gravity well, and great jets of fire escape from its underhull.
The Nova Cannon is now a semi-fused hunk of virulent metal, doused in foulness and folding in on itself like paper in a clenched fist. The tox dump carries on eating, fizzing and consuming and melting, causing fresh explosions to ripple along the intact metalwork. Vorks watches it die on the rear-facing viewers. There is a plea.